Awesome. Okay, we're recording. Jason, welcome back onto the Jake Woodhouse podcast. How are you doing?
I'm good, Jake. Thank you.
Very excited for this conversation. And I thought that the way I would tee it up for everyone is, first of all, go back and listen to the episode that we did all the way back at the start of this year for more context on who you are and equally the relationship we have, which is a mentoring one in which we speak on a weekly basis. And you've helped me hugely to reframe what I consider to be work in a way that is empowering me rather than what previously has been happening, which is it's I've been doubting myself essentially. And that area is in humanistic investing. So what would be cool is just a very brief recap as to like how you even came across this concept of humanistic intellectual and financial wealth, because that story is really cool. And then we'll spend as much time as we can kind of unpacking, well, what is humanistic capital and how can you invest in it?
It is an interesting story, and we'll give the full version of it, the woo-woo version
Go
of
for
it.
it.
So my father had passed away a couple of months earlier after 9 years of dealing with cancer, and he had been very successful in his business, and he had been in throughout my lifetime, he was working in butchering and in farming. So he had a trout farm, he had fine wool merino sheep, and he had butcher shops. And long story short, got to a point in his life where he became ill and passed away. And after that, it all sort of happened for me at that point. I'd sort of had my whole life had got to a point, it was 12 years ago, my whole life got to a point where, you know, people talk about having the rock bottom experience. So I had a day when it was a bad afternoon, and in that afternoon, I had my health had collapsed. My mental health was on its way out as well. Mental wellness was on its way out. I'd had a side. I was in a job. I had to let that go that day. I had a business that I'd been working towards for like 28 years, and I was like, I'm going to have to hand this over to my offsider because that's it. I'm too ill to go on. And I'd been working for decades to live in the north of Tasmania to set up a life there. And in that one day, it all sort of came crashing to a halt. And when I talked to my boss and said, I'm done, and I was packing my office, my desk up, I, got the call, you need to come to the hospital now. And Dad passed away that evening. So it was like it all happened on one day. And it was interesting because within a couple of months, like all of those things played out, and everything sort of passed away that I'd been building. And my wife had to go back to work. We had two young kids. One was 1 year old, and one was would have been about six and a half. And so my wife had to go to work because I was too sick to work, and I was stay at home. And it was a lot. It was a lot at that time. And anyway, the story is we went into Hobart one day when we first moved south, and I had $20 in my wallet. And my wife Karen said to me, said, look, just go have a walk around town. She was taking the kids to buy some clothes and said, just go and have a walk around town. And if, you know, here's $20 if you get yourself a drink or something as you're wandering around, do whatever, you know, we'll give you a call when we're ready to go. And I was walking along the street, and then I got this incredibly strong perception about my father. And it was like I was walking along, and I looked up, and it's just like that little flash out of the corner of your eye, like he was standing there pointing uphill up this street. And I was just like, okay. That was weird, but it was like, well, I am walking around town. And as I'm walking around town, I'm walking along, I'm thinking, this is weird. I wonder why I'm supposed to walk up here. And I get in line with this secondhand bookshop, and they had a little window, not much bigger than like what this is presenting with the camera. And there was a book. So I look in the display, and there's like this guy's got a book, and he's like like this, and it's kind of like,
Yeah.
you know, God, give me a sign. And the book was on intergenerational family wealth. And as soon as I saw the title, I was just like, oh, walked in. I said to this guy, can I have a look at that book? And he had a look at it. It's like, yep, this is what it's about. And I'm like, well, this is exactly what my father wanted me to know. And and I said, how much for the book? And he said, well, he said, it's an $80 book. He said, oh, I was going to sell it for $30, but, you know, I can't even get to sit on the display stand. So, look, $20, it's yours. And $20, there you go, done. And I walked away reading this book and I learned a couple of things. It's a very interesting one. You and I have talked about it before and you've read it yourself. But there was a couple of principles that came out of it. And one of it was about the relationship of generations in creating wealth, how one generate like and how basically how it aligns with universal law about the transmutation of energy. So things go through a creation phase and then stasis and then decay. So there is a statement in that book, which is that we go from like shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. So the first generation has nothing. So they build their empire and then their kids have witnessed that. They've grown up around that, but they didn't do it. So they have enough knowledge of it to know how to maintain the energy of it, but not enough to create it again themselves. And then generally their kids come along and the grandkids, well, they've never known anything but wealth. So all they know how to do is spend it. And then by the end of their generation, it's right back and the next generation has to then start in the, you know, in the dirt again and build their own empires. So that was a fascinating thing because I experienced it. I watched it happen many, many times. And it was part of a thing that I didn't understand how it worked. But the other aspect of it was a key aspect of creating wealth through generations was understanding that wealth has multiple aspects to it. And money and the things money buys are only a part of it. And so it broke that it gave a model that said, okay, we have three kinds of wealth. There's financial wealth or capital, there's intellectual capital, and then there's humanistic capital. And that to me on one level was news. So I was very aware of what it looked like because I was broke humanistically. I was broke financially. I had a lot of information, but I couldn't piece it together. So I was missing the key bits that put it all into a functioning sense. And that started me looking for that work. But yeah, so that's sort of how I came across that information. But
It's just amazing. Yeah. As you retold it, I could feel it. That whole like, oh, he wants me to go up here. Just extraordinary kind of almost out of body feeling of this is the right direction. And yes, of course, I've got the perfect amount of money for.
Yeah, exactly right, isn't it?
You know, just extraordinary. But one of the things that has resonated very strongly for me recently about this particular framework that. So it's fitted into my model of the world very nicely in a way that has basically made me more sophisticated as a capital allocator. Mm. It's like capital is not just financial capital. You've got these other buckets that you can play around with that if you're not allocating effectively to them, you're missing the point. Yes. And my father, bless him, RIP dad, died of a heart attack, 48 years old, running his family business, my family business back in England, but incredibly stressed. And he overworked himself to the bone, basically, and he died. And so what's the lesson from that? Well, obviously, I'm incentivized for history not to repeat itself. But in many ways, the last 15 years has been about asking questions. Why did that happen? Is that the right approach? What was he doing that maybe I shouldn't be doing, or whatever the case might be? And so this idea of humanistic wealth as part of this discussion is so important because if you don't top up that bucket or your intellectual one for that matter, then you can't drive financial gains. It's as simple as that. Yeah, so exactly. Let's spend a bit of time trying to define then. So what do you mean by humanistic wealth in this sense?
So humanistic wealth, is really the ability for you and the people you love to thrive.
Hmm.
That's what it is in a nutshell. So there's kind of, from my perspective, there's like this, we go through three processes of wealth building or wealth, experience of wealth. So the first one is scarcity. And in scarcity, what we're doing is that we're learning how to restrict or how to deal with the restriction of good. I'm a spiritual mentor, so my perspective on all this is about the universe in which we live as an energetic universe. And so whilst that's not really at odds with, you know, mainstream thinking on many levels, it's a little bit broader than most perception. So to look at things like scarcity, we're in an ocean of grace. So good is surrounds us at all times. And the reason that we don't experience it is because we don't let it in, not because it's not there. And that process of scarcity is us experiencing our limitations around that. And when we process that, we move out of the varying kinds of poverty that we develop there. And then we move into a point where we start to thrive in a healthy way. And the literal definition of that, that's the definition of the word prosper. So when we hit a point of prosperity, said life is good. We're comfortable. We've got what we want and things are going really well with that. But there's a level of prosperity that comes in where the flow of resources are coming in at such a pace and with such sophistication that we have to actually evolve in order to manage them. And that's abundance. So that's what we're really aiming at with all of it. Because if we're not creating that evolution in ourselves, we're missing out on the real reason why we come here. So it's a big picture thing. So humanistic wealth, just to take it in itself, humanistic wealth is everything that you need to thrive. It's the relationships you engage in. It is the food that you eat. It's the way in which you move your body. It's time in nature. It's beauty. It's art. It's travel. It's good books. It's great sex. It's everything that you need to thrive. Because when you are looking at it from a wealth building perspective, it's just as much effort to create all three simultaneously as it is to just focus on cash. So it's no more work. You just have to frame it slightly differently. Mm-hmm. And if you, and my experience with it in is that out of those three, the intellectual, so I mean financial, we understand that's profit, loss, money in, money out, liabilities and assets, said, and all the variations upon, said, everything you expect in capital allocation and management, that is financial wealth. But intellectual wealth, part of that is knowledge, academic knowledge, you know, that is certainly valuable, but the essence of it is wisdom, the ability to apply and to create, in get an idea in your head, have the understanding of how to make it happen, and then make it happen. That application of genius is really what is at the root of wisdom. And wisdom is the ability for you to make better quality decisions moving forward. And that is undeniable wealth. Mm-hmm. And the third one, humanistic, of course, the ability for you to thrive, to have that quality of life. Because if you have those three working together, what you end up with is you end up with this breadth and depth of wealth that goes way beyond just how much money you give people. And I suppose it's easier to explore it in the negative because it's easier to see it in the negative. Most people that focus on, I mean, my father did it, I did it, you know, and your father had the same experience, is that when we focus on just one aspect of it at the expense of the others, said, how much does it cost us financially when the humanistic wealth collapses? Most people who make a fortune in their younger years working themselves into the ground to make that money, they get that money, and as they get older, they spend most of that money either in the failed relationships, they lose it in divorces, the problems with their kids, and or their health collapsing. So at the end of the day, it's like, what really was it worth, apart from your own vanity to say, look what I did, I got more numbers than other people got. So,
and there's an interesting word that comes up at the very end of that, being vanity, which I think plays into this idea of ego as well, where who are you competing against other than yourself, right?
Yeah.
And even having the wherewithal to actually observe that is probably the first step. And something I'm experiencing as well. What I'd love to do, Jason, is just to spend a bit of time again thinking about, you know, what you described. I think you said, you know, pretty close to rock bottom, right? Your father's died, your sickness is so bad that you can't work, you've got young kids, your missus had to go back and work. Like, fuck, this was not the plan.
No.
How did, and I smirk because I know that things have changed a lot for you, but how did you go from that man to then today being able to articulate what you just did? Like, there must have been some, like, this book was obviously a big moment because it's like, ah, this is a slightly different way of looking at the world than I previously knew even existed. What if I start reapplying this? Were there some other moments or points of inspiration along that process that helped, like, pull those pieces together and really, like, you know, you're moving out of that scarcity mindset into abundance?
Yeah, well, absolutely. So, the thing was, I suppose one of the things interesting about it is that when I said it was like, it was pretty close to rock bottom, is that I'd had previous rock bottoms. And the one that hit me the hardest, because rock bottom, I used to do a lot of support work, and rock bottom is the thing that support workers and social workers and psychologists and everybody are terrified, because they don't understand what it is. So they look at it and they think, you know, a person might commit suicide. So, and I suppose we need a little trigger warning because I'm going to talk about suicide. A person might commit suicide, and people think that that's rock bottom. That's not. That's what your ego does to stop you from hitting rock bottom. Rock bottom is when you hit the consequences of your life choices face first with so much momentum that it actually bounces you back up onto your feet. Wow. That's rock bottom. And a problem with our society is that we're so terrified of rock bottom that we're constantly trying to break people's fall. And we see this all the time in things like mental health and physical health and so forth, is that we spend so much time breaking the momentum that when a person hits the ground, they lay on it and they don't get up. They don't bounce. They haven't hit it hard enough. So they just stabilize there, and it ends up becoming a chronic condition. So for me, the rock bottom for me happened 3 years earlier when my wife left me, is that we'd lost the ability to communicate. Said we were so much external pressure on the relationship, and we had lost the ability to communicate to each other because there was all this other stuff coming in that we're dealing with, and there was business pressure, and there was money, and there was, you know, family things, and, you know, all of this stuff. So it killed our relationship, and we went through the entire process of mediation and setting up visitation and all those sorts of things. Like we were done. And then we reached a point where, and this is, I have to give it to Karen, because I'd like to say it was all my wisdom. It was like, no, she finally got it through to me that it was like, you know, you're really fucking it up. Right? And yeah. I knew I was, because I just couldn't get it right. And it wasn't for a lack of effort. It was like, I just, there's rules and I don't know them. And I was taking other people's advice. I was working with other people's advice, but I didn't realize that the people's advice I was taking said they were not the people you listen to. And I was getting predictable results based on the quality of information I was getting. So our relationship separated. But what happened was we were able to work through it, bring it back together again. And then we started building. And it was in building that, that trying to build going forward, that's when all of this stuff came to a head. And then my health collapsed under the under that. And wow. And that was still not rock bottom, because rock bottom happened, I think, probably, goodness, probably about 6 months later. 6 months later, my health really collapsed. And I ended up with a, I was a wreck. I was a complete wreck. I'd gone to the point where I couldn't work. I was not well enough to hold down a job. But I'd got to the point where I was so sick. It's like, it used to take me like 45 minutes, 50 minutes to do a load of dishes in a rack. And then I'd have to go and lie down. And half an hour later, I'd have enough recovery to get up. And then I'd dry dishes. And then I'd have to go and lie down. And that was my day, like trying to do something, lie down, trying to do something, lie down. And so my health was completely cactus. And talking to healthcare professionals, and they all just said, they said, you're fucked. They said, if you're, you know, if you're lucky, you'll get a pension, but your wife's gone to work in the public service, so they may not work for you because you're already, you know, she's earning over the threshold. So, you know, basically that's it. Usefulness as a man in the home is pretty limited. And I did not like that answer at all. And then I started to develop this other thing called trigeminal neuralgia, which is it's like an inflammation of the nerve that covers like one side of your head. And what it's like is every 7 seconds getting stabbed through the face right into the center of your brain. And relentless.
Every 7 seconds.
Every 7 seconds, yeah. Just wham.
Wow.
So, yeah, its nickname is suicide migraines. And that's because that's how most people treat it. So wow. I had an experience with it that, like I said before, my father had a trout farm. And there's a thing with fish farming that you learn about, like, temperature and oxygenation. And with trigeminal neuralgia, the only thing they can do to lessen the pain, they give you painkillers, but the only thing that seems to actually work upon it is oxygen. And I was in this car park. I had the two girls. We went to town to get something, and I was struggling. And I remember I was standing there, and I looked up, and there was a McDonald's. And I looked at this McDonald's, and I went, I've got an idea. And I went and got a thick shake, and I stuck the straw right up into my cheek as much as I could, and I sucked it up there like stucco, right? And then the pain stopped for about 30 seconds. And I was like, I think I understand what's going on. The anti-inflammatories and the painkillers are stopping the body from being able to process it. It's keeping it in a chronic state. So I went off the painkillers. I'd been accidentally taking double the amount. I'd misread the instructions at that point. I was off my head. And anyway, I went off the painkillers and I woke up the next day and my bed was drenched. I had massive fever. My bed was drenched and it was gone. And
wow.
And it was like, okay, now we start to move. We start to get moving. And I was starting to think about, because the main thing at that point that I'd learned from that book that Dad had shown me was really that universal law is a thing. There's rules to how the world works. And I'd always suspected it, but I never really understood it. And I had one. I had transmutation of energy. And it was like, okay. So started to research, but most importantly, start to apply. And then as you start to apply, things start to move. And I ended up getting a beautiful mentor who lived next door to me, and Bess de Groot. And she's still one of my closest friends and mentors. And she, as an energetic therapist and you know, natural therapy practitioner, she did the Humpty Dumpty. She just put me back together again. And wow. I got up and running. She trained me. She showed me how to put it all together. And then I started doing the work that I was doing. And that led from one opportunity to the next. And as it went, and my study of everything I was trying to learn about this as we're going, it started to just pick up the experience, but you pick up the knowledge. And that's the thing. So that, like I say, we're in an ocean of grace. When you start, you make a decision, this is exactly what you're going to do. The way the universe conspires to assist you is insane. It's absolutely crazy how much can come in.
Well, Jason, thank you for sharing all of this. It's always infinitely fascinating to me how we became who we are today. And there are countless different experiences that one has through their life that slightly alter the course you're on. It's like a constant process of the search for product market fit.
Yeah.
To take like a startup term, you know, it's like, okay, which direction do I go in right now? And always slightly changing. There is a number of terms that you've brought up that I don't think most people listening will understand. And I think it would be really cool to spend some time covering those. And the first major one that you've touched on a couple of times now is the idea of energy transmutation.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? And could you give some examples as to how you can apply that to day-to-day life?
Yeah, sure. So energy transmutation is a recognition that energy, when energy is brought into form, it goes through three predictable steps. There's actually four of them, but from most like a physics model, when they look at it, they say there's three. And those three are, there is a creation phase, and then there's a stasis, and then there's entropy or decay. So in a business sense, a person turns around and says, all right, I'm going to build my business. I'm going to build $1 million business, okay, just as a number. And they build $1 million business. Well, when they first start, energy is released in that process. So there's motivation, enthusiasm, there's interest. You know, we're rocking along and we're building and building and building and building. And then we hit $1 million, which is what we told our subconscious was all we're allowed to have. And then we stop creating and we now just flatten out and we're just trying to maintain that structure. But as we're doing it, there's all these entropic forces, you know, the market's changing, time is going on, staff come and go, people have got different motivations, someone gets sick, we have another kid, you know, all these things start to work upon that very stable $1 million business. And if I don't change anything, well, even inflation, if I don't change anything, then that $1 million starts to fall down. And as it goes, it picks up momentum because the rate of decay increases. And then eventually it falls apart and that business doesn't exist anymore. So where people create lasting wealth, and I think that book, the thing that I found really interesting about that book is it was written by a guy, I'm really sorry, I don't remember his name.
I did look it up. James E. Hughes Jr., American lawyer.
Yeah, but he was in international trade law, business law. And he had a niche that he had worked in a lot, which was offering financial advice and setting up a structure for families that had wealth for a long time. So, you know, not just one or two generations. We're talking people that have had it for like 850 years. And he was working with these families in Asia, families in Europe, and also families in America and so on around the world, UK. And you had people that had wealth for centuries. And he was always fascinated in that because the more he talked to them, they all said they had the same fear. And that fear was shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations, or even in Asia, because he said about that and they said, oh, yeah, we're terrified of that. That's the same. We have the same saying. It's rice field to rice field in three generations. They said, but because everyone's identified that it's like, yeah, that thing of the three generations of the transmutation of energy is a real thing. And the reason that they were engaging his services in the first place is they were thinking, how do we break that cycle? And it's a fascinating question. And from my perspective, the way in which you break that cycle is that you don't. You work with it. And if you work with it, what you do is that you make every generation the first generation. Everybody is encouraged to create their own thing. And in doing that, we end up not with a line on a graph, but we end up with all of these threads going through their cycles of creation, creation, stasis, and decay. And they're all woven together, and they're like a rope. They're just all these fibers make this immensely strong mass that goes on. It gives the illusion of permanence, but there's nothing could be further from the truth. Said, this is a living thing. And when we understand, we start working, we start creating, said, the other universal laws and natural laws become self-evident. So, yeah, it's in that. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Very, very cool. Yeah, whether it's relationship or anything.
I'm just trying to find something here. So we had a mentoring session a couple of weeks ago, and I've been going through, as you know, a real shift around this podcast and what it represents. And what you've just teed up is an excellent segue into like this use case in a sense. And it's like, what are we actually doing here? It's like, what's the point charging around creating all this stuff our whole life when the people that you give it to just don't understand what to do with it? And so unless you are sophisticated enough to understand that you need to be investing into your humanistic wealth and your intellectual capital to drive financial returns, the next generation also need to be investing into their humanistic and intellectual capital in the same way. And so it's that transfer of knowledge from one generation to the next that's like really crucial piece of this puzzle. But where I've struggled and what I noticed recently is I absolutely blitzed it to like 100 episodes, hit 250,000 views, loving it, but it came at a cost. And a lot of that was in Pat and Michael, shout out to those guys who I hired to help produce and edit all the content that we were pumping out every day, all this stuff. Great feedback for it, but I hadn't figured out a revenue model. I was like, I'll just do costs in year one. I'll deal with revenue in year two. And as I started thinking about the different ways of making money from 250,000 views, every single revenue option requires time and attention, whether it's an affiliate marketing program or if it's some kind of high-end coaching program. You sell someone 10 grand of coaching, you've then got to fulfill that. It sounds really obvious, right? But I was guilty of charging into a project that I wrapped up as this next massive business opportunity when actually I don't need to sell my time for money anymore. And this is an extraordinarily, admittedly, first world problem to have, but it's a result of my father dying young, inheriting money, and being a capital allocator in a financial sense, fucking it up a bunch of times, coming across Bitcoin, realizing, oh, actually, we can just save. We don't have to invest. All right, we'll sack the financial advisor, do this thing over here. But even with that being true, leaving behind the conditioned mindset of work, 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 work has been really difficult and is an ongoing game. And this is where the humanistics lens is so fascinating, because it's actually like, what if that's your job? And right now I'm homeschooling my kids, and it's about investing into them and my friendships with them and how they set out in the world. And I wrote an article that I posted on my Nostra account recently. And in it, I quoted you from one of our previous sessions. And you reframed this so well. It's like, I'm just going to quote it back now. So your focus is on solving the humanistic problem. All we have to do is expand our job. Your work is thinking about legacy of multi-generational healing via multi-dimensional application of time, space, and energy. With humanistic, intellectual, and financial capital to pass down to your kids via energy transmutation, the idea of each generation being the first generation, the legacy of each person as a pioneer. Now that's an interesting job to have. And it is. And it's like, hell yeah, how do we make that happen? And so to your point, working with this universal law of energy transmutation, of creation, stasis, and decline, the philosophy, perhaps, or the intellectual wisdom is the application of that through the intergenerational wealth management. It's like, no, you're absolutely going to get given every bit of space you need to go and figure out what it is you love, where you want to make a mistake a gazillion times until you figure it out. And the family will encourage that.
Yeah.
I mean, how cool is that? So where did, to follow on this timeline, like, how did you start to piece some of those bits of the puzzle together? And it's been really good for me to pull it together and go, okay, well, my day job's now my homeschooling dad job. And then it's my health. And then at 8:38 at night, it's do what you find fun and have a creative project such as a podcast that is not about making money in the first instance. And that reframe has totally changed my day. I'm no longer stressed about posting stuff. I'm no longer worried about like what all these things I've got to do. And I guess that's the beauty of a mentor, right? You know, it's helped me hugely. So anything that resonates out of that, Jason?
It's really powerful. I often, because of the nature of my work, I talk to people about all manner of things. And I really never know what I got until I sit down with somebody. So, because that's kind of that's the niche that I fit in. So people come to me with unusual problems. But I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations with people where they talk about stresses in their relationship, for example, which is a humanistic wealth. And they say, you know, oh, my wife's saying that she wants to go to marriage counseling. And it's like, oh, so are you going to do that? And like, oh, I don't want to. You know, it's expensive. It doesn't work. And it's like, oh, okay. So how do you know? Well, you know, people tell me, you know, it's like, you know, it can be like $200 or $300 a session. So that could be like $600 or $800. And I always say to them, I say, well, yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? But what do you reckon your net worth is? I said, because whatever half of that is, that's what you're going to lose for not going to counseling. It doesn't matter whether the counseling, I mean, guys, if you've got your, if somebody's listening to this and they're saying, my spouse is saying to me, I think we should go to counseling, let me explain it to you in simple terms. She's saying, I just want you to put an effort into something other than your project. I want you to put energy into me. And it doesn't matter whether or not the advice is good. The fact that you got off your ass and made the decision that you're interested in something humanistic and not just financial, that will probably save your relationship. And if you can't feel the value of humanistic wealth, it's like, just think about half your net worth and you're going to hand plus legals, right? That's what the monetary value of humanistic is in its crudest form. So all the time, we get this all the time, is that our society doesn't reward what is valuable. We constantly being told about how important children are, how important the future is, and yet teachers, healthcare workers, mothers, said stay-at-home parents, right, they're offered nothing. They're really badly paid, if paid at all, in our society. And if and particularly with women, if women decide that they're going to have kids, then they're financially punished for it. And yet, what else is it that we're building that's a value except for your family? It's the absolute root of humanistic wealth is the people that you love thrive. And one of those people have to be you, because it's a trickle down. If you don't thrive and your relationship with your spouse doesn't thrive, well, your kids, they're in that. So they're not going to thrive. And what we do when we take control of things like humanistic wealth is that we shift. And I remember having a lovely conversation with Dr. Ash Moreland, and she's like a neuroscientist. And we were talking about these concepts, and she said, okay, so, and I'm going to quote her because wish I'd thought of it, right? She said, so what you're saying is that if we do this, we go from being a carrier of intergenerational trauma to a carrier of intergenerational healing. And it's like, just let that land for a minute. Said, how much stuff in your life that you look back on and go, wow, you know, my parents, my grandparents, my aunties, my uncles, their parents. So they really did a number on us. Said, yeah. Well, it could stop with you. You could be the one that stops it. Your kids could look back and go, oh, yeah. Said, you know, mum and dad may not have been perfect, but oh, my God, what we got from them. Said, that's our legacy. Because, you know.
And legacy is such a powerful word, isn't it?
Absolutely.
To try and bring this concept into kind of, you know, if someone's out there listening, thinking, oh, well, how do I improve my life? You know, these guys are banging on about humanistic wealth. It sounds like the first step is to improve yourself. You've just almost kind of touched through this, and that filters through to the rest of you and your family or whatever might be your close-knit relationships. How do you start? What's the best way to, is there a best way to go about this, do you think?
Yeah, I think what you got to do, if I was to... If someone says to me, like, because since the time that I had all that stuff go to crap and I started to pick myself up and change quality of life, right? My life is very, very different today. And if I was to say, what was the single most important thing that I did? The single most important thing that I did was I stopped bloody listening to everyone else. Mm. I started to go in and say, actually, what matters to me? Because it wasn't, I thought it was work. I thought it was building a legacy. I thought it was, you know, the making the money and giving my family a quality of life. And at the end of the day, all they wanted was to spend time with me. Mm. And it was like, well, I wasn't spending time with me. So, of course, I wasn't comprehending that they would want to do that. So when I started to really spend time with me, not just like in meditation and so on, but to look at it and go, well, no, actually, what do I care about? What do I like? What do I like to eat? What do I like to wear? What do I like to read? Hobbies do I want? What's, you know, even what do I watch on TV? It's like we just go with the flow most times. And a lot of what we think are our goals are not our goals at all. They're just preconditioned responses. And we've got... When we can get out of that paradigm and start to go, no, how do I actually think? Said, start making decisions from that point. Said, your priorities shift so much that it's quite staggering. And yet to the outside, it doesn't look like anything's changed. You know, it's like, oh, somebody's now going to the gym or somebody's now, you know, into mountain biking or somebody likes to go to the movies on a Thursday arvo or, you know, or going on holidays with their kids or whatever. So that's all it looks like, is that it's not some massive, you don't have to go for the complete transformation. So one of the big things at the moment is we have a really big problem in the Western paradigm of immature masculinity and femininity. And I won't say toxic because from my perspective, you have masculine, you have feminine, you have toxic, and they're completely separate things. Arsehole's an arsehole. Doesn't matter what their gender is, right? Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is a problem. So for us, it's we have this immature masculinity. If I explain it, like think about who says this. You got to be 6 foot, earn six figures. You've got to date, you know, only models. You've got to be driving supercars. You've got to be living like James Bond. So that's a 12-year-old boy's fantasy of what it is to be a successful adult. Mm. It's immature. Most people in the West are being sold this idea that a successful man in particular is a 12-year-old boy. It's ridiculous. Mature masculinity is understanding your capacity for leadership and mentorship and being a provider and being a creator of safety. It's developing quality relationships and being that foundation of healing for everybody that knows you. So that's where your real legacy is, because on one level, like your mother is always your mother. You know, from your father, you got one cell. you got one cell and half of your first cell, and all the rest your mum built, and she built in her own body by changing her body, and then she pushed out your body. And so your mother is always your mother, regardless of who they are as a person. But your father is very much about legacy. It's who they are, their example of who they were as a person, their integrity is what stays with you long after everything else goes. So it's those important lessons. It's like an initiation is what we get from them.
And Jason, on that same line of thought, so the masculine characteristics you just took us through, what would be today's state from a feminine perspective?
Well, they're basically the same. So there's this kind of my observation of it, the model that I use. I like to make models, right? Mm-hmm. So literally and figuratively. So with creating these systems, usable tools. So for me, masculinity and femininity are very, they're basically the same categories. There's five of them. So you have in the masculine, I'll start with the masculine, it's the easiest to see it. So it's like we have the provider, which is the ability for you to solve the problems of life, not just money. And I mean, and to be fair, in our society, what's the first problem every man needs to solve? How to make money, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you don't know how to make money, you don't get to have all the other problems. So the next one is being a protector. Now, being a protector means that you have a quality about you where you will move towards danger to allow the people that you love to be safe. The third one is leadership. And that means that you have a vision of your own life that's so big that you can invite people into it and they can grow and still not be suffocated within it. Is that you can hold a vision for the people that you love that allows them to grow to their full capacity and still be held by you. That's genuine leadership. And then if you can think in multiple generations, then that's mentorship. And then the last one is safety creation. And that is that people need to feel safe just because you're there. And they need to feel safe from you. And in order to create that, you have to be a little bit dangerous on some levels. You have to be able to go when push comes to shove, you're quite happy to shove back. And it's the men and women that I've known that are really excellent in that safety creation said they're terrifyingly dangerous individuals. They're like ex-military and, high-level martial artists, extremely physically fit powerlifters, people like that. So these are people that if they lost it, it's a problem. Yeah. But they don't lose it. Their ability to be regulated is what creates a safety. The fact if you are dangerous and you don't get angry at people, not because it's suppressed, but because it's fine. You've got such control of your emotions that your anger is not an explosion of dysregulation. So if you have that, the safety that creates in the nervous systems of the people around you, and particularly when the masculine to the feminine, what it does is it allows a woman to be in her feminine. If you don't turn up in those factors, she has to turn up. And that means she can't be who she is. So as a provider, the provider is nurturing in the protection. It's the same. It's the protection, but she's protecting your heart. She's protecting your soul. She's a visionary the same. She's a mentor the same and a safety creator. Women are built to do one thing that men are not, and that is navigate chaos. And the single most terrifying force in the universe for men is chaos. And that is why, like, sailors used to carve women into the figureheads of their ships, right? So the ocean was the absolute metaphor of chaos, and they needed a woman to guide them through it. It was what gave them the strength. I used to be a civil monk in a Buddhist order, and Shaolin disciple. And in those sort of temple structures, so they don't revere many like deities or anything like that. said, but there's a couple of those operative spirits that they do revere. And the most important of them is Guan Yin, which is a woman. Or technically, it is the embodiment of the feminine compassion, of mercy. And that's because men can't reach their potential. You cannot reach your potential as a mature man initiated into those mysteries without a mature woman doing that with you. And the paradox is she can't do it either. So it requires the masculine and feminine. And even in like same-sex relationships and so forth, one will hold the masculine energy, one will hold the feminine energy. And they may switch roles. And we may switch roles, like in a heterosexual couple, may switch roles. Sometimes the woman is in a masculine and the guy's in the feminine. And it's fine. It's that interplay is really important. But for women in particular, everything is about safety. And anything, if you're having trouble in your relationship on any level, and you're a guy and the woman in your life is struggling with you on some level, then that is because you're not making her safe. And if you can figure out where you're not making her safe, then if you solve that problem, you'll solve the problem. So it's interesting. Most of the stuff we have in those dynamics, we think they're all complex communication issues. They're not. They're simple. We're very simple. I'm very sophisticated, but we're also very simple. So
it's fascinating. And I love listening to you break these kind of things down. And it strikes me very clearly that this is intellectual capital. So yeah. This is information that is revealing itself to me right now in this conversation for me to then do what I might need with it, apply wisdom, essentially, or creativity, however you might describe that. And that intellectual capital, when deployed effectively, is a bolster to your humanistic. Like in particular, when you're thinking about your relationship with your other half and like, how can you improve this? Where is it not going as well as it could go? What you just described immediately made me think about the last 3 years of moving from rental property to rental property with one kid and then two kids and then three kids. And it got really intense at points. And essentially your wife is like, I'm not safe.
Yeah.
Why am I not safe right now? That's on you, mate. And it is. There's nowhere to fucking hide. And it triggers the shit out of you because you're not good enough. And it's like, all right, well, how do I solve that problem? And of course, that's one specific example. There's different ways of doing it. Very cool though, Jason. So to kind of come back to that question of how does someone implement some of these things in their life, it's essentially like, think about what you want. You know, that sounds so simple, but... please, I can see you have a comment. Take it from there.
Get into the truth of it, not what you think you want. It's why I was talking about the immature masculinity, because most, just, you know, being a guy, said most of the stuff we're presented as a guy is some form of, you know, you want to do well in school or sport, so you can then make lots of money. With lots of money, you get yourself a good wife or endless string of girlfriends, whatever it is that you feel you need. And then you're going to have status. And that status is going to give you power. And that power you're going to use to make lots more money. And you're going to, the cycle will continue around and around and around. I said, well, that might have been a good idea for somebody, but it may not be yours at all. Some people, what they want more than anything is just to have quiet time at home, have a lovely garden, to watch their kids grow up and nurture their children into having a happy life. So there's not a right or wrong answer. There's really only right or wrong for you. So if what we're doing, if we don't stop and say what actually matters to me, then we're going to burn all of our time and our space and our energy pursuing goals that ultimately are empty to us. We'll accomplish them and then we'll get there and go, what was that all about?
What was the point of that? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that makes me think back to what I touched on before about where I'd got the podcast to, accelerated out of the gates, essentially, and then realized, like, who am I doing this for? And there I was once again seeking validation externally for something that ultimately was supposed to be a creative pursuit for internal. Yeah. And that's the loop. It's like, there it is. And obviously, it's your wife that points it out. And you're like, what are you talking about?
That's, you know, there's, you're a, like, reason, oh, there's a reason why I've you're done getting that thing. Yeah.
It's like, I've done that thing again, haven't I? And in some ways, trying to prove myself to my father, who's been dead for over 15 years. Why? He's not here, Jake. You know, what do you want? And I think that's almost, it's so confronting in some ways, isn't it? Because only you can answer that. There's no textbook for it. There's no mentor for it. There's no wife for it. No, nothing, right? It's like, no, this is going to come down to you and you alone. Oh my gosh. And so, Jason, I'm intrigued to flesh a bit more around this idea of being a spiritual mentor. So for those that have listened so far, we, you know, coming up to an hour, you've got a bit more time, Jason.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, cool. Yep, let's go for it. And so I had some questions from some audience members, because I posted something this morning saying I've got my energetics mentor, Jason, coming on. We're going to do a deep dive on humanistic capital. And someone called Beep Boop, whoever they are, have a question. The fuck is energetics mentor? Like, what does that even mean? I'd love to start there, because I think it's a great question, right? We've already talked through this concept of energy transmutation, but like, what would you really describe energetics as a very kind of high level, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah. So I suppose there's different things about this. I suppose for me, I look at what I do is applied spiritual principles. So in mentoring is different to teaching. Teaching is get it out of a book, right? Mentoring is what you are sharing because you're using it. So that's why I use the term mentoring. I don't say I'm a teacher of these principles, because I'm using it. And if I'm not using it, I'm not sharing it, because it's out of integrity. And I'm interested in building that rope forward. So because I want to build that rope, it's like, you can't be out of integrity. That just cuts your rope every time. And if you want to know what'll put it into a decay cycle, get out of integrity. That'll nail it straight away. So from an energetic perspective, I trained in energetic therapies, which is a way of creating healing and change in the body by communicating on a very subtle level of perception. And you develop that ability. There's techniques for it, but you actually create it through certain kinds of meditation. And because I'd done that for many years, I've got a level of perception that's different to the average punter. And I'm able to see things that other people cannot see. And because of that, understanding principles, I can manipulate those things to affect healing, to affect change, to release trauma, to work through a whole range of things. And studying those principles, that's what I do. I started off my business as such, built itself around the fact that I was extremely good at assisting people with supernatural trauma and being able to resolve that where other people were unable to resolve it, and being really good in that corner of the market. It just expanded into people as people come to you in a crisis. And once they come out of that crisis, they start to grow and they go, what's next? And you go, well, what about this? And they started to grow and grow. And then people started hassle me to mentor. And then I started mentoring. And then I started doing like masterclasses and group mentoring and all those sorts of things. I let it grow organically through universal law. So, that's my perception of it. I went to most people, when they think about things like that perception, they think about things like clairvoyance and stuff like that. He said, that's a very small little corner of it. And I remember the first time I really met my people was I was visiting a mentee of mine asked me to come along to a workshop they were running. And there was, in this room, there was like 25 people. They were all very, very sophisticated, very successful entrepreneurs. They were also what you would call clairvoyance, clairaudience. They had a very high level of perception. None of them were working at the Mind-Body Festival reading cards. What they were doing is they were using their deep understanding of the sophisticated movement of energy to be able to be better investors, better business people. They were reading the market before the market was reading the market. They were cornering their industries and building great businesses using this level of perception. And this level of perception, so there's lots of people out there that just don't talk about it because, too busy winning.
Well, and is that... Where do you get your edge? And if your edge is something such as the talents you just described, A, most people can't figure that out anyway. But also it's like, that's your edge. Why would you share it?
Exactly right.
It doesn't make sense. You're giving away your IP, essentially.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, Jason, it reminds me of our previous episode we did that, again, I'll point people back to from earlier this year where we first met. Due to you helping with my second daughter, Cleo, and clearing some elemental spirits. It was an extraordinary experience that was, for me, the first like hard example of a kind of supernatural world that it happened right in front of my eyes. And then I got a different child afterwards. I don't want to go into that story now. I'll send people back to the previous episode. But you touch on the universal laws. What would be cool is to spend some time breaking down what those are. And it sounds like, you were looking for a set of rules that you knew must be out there and you clearly didn't understand what they were because you were like rock bottom or close to rock bottom. Third time or whatever. What do you mean by universal law?
So universal law are really the principles that underpin how our reality works, the universe in which we live. So there's, just to give you an idea, so there's a number of them. I work with about 16 of them, and I work with principles around laws of the body, laws of the soul, laws of the pain body, and some of the spiritual laws, which are different again. So ideas, examples of spiritual laws are things like karmic laws, things like compassion. Universal laws are things like cause and effect, energy transmutation, law of attraction, law of vibration, law of divine timing. So these are universal laws. And then you have laws of the soul and laws of the pain body. And I won't get into those because they're kind of not for people that are uninitiated. If you go into that and your subconscious starts to realize you're aware of that, so that will start to make your entire life unravel. And if you don't have the tools to be able to work with that, you're just going to do your head in and do in everything else around you. So some knowledge, everything costs. And some intellectual wealth, it costs a lot. So with universal law is that if you understand how it works, you create effects that are outside of the norm. So I've really successfully worked for probably the last 8 years. I started my business about 10 years ago, I think, 10, 11 years ago. And when I first started it, I started advertising to all these things, nothing happened. In the first 12 months, I got 4 sessions. None of them were paid and they were given to me by my mentor. I said, hey, can you do this for me? And I'm like, sure. And at that point, I was just like, whatever work I could pick up, I would be happy with. And I got to a point where I made a decision. I was watching a documentary and I saw this person reach in, touch a person's soul. And I knew what I was looking at. The moment I saw it, I woke up. It was like that there, that's what I'm going to do. And I don't care if I don't have any clients. I'm just going to drill and drill and drill and drill until I become that level of practitioner, and eventually the people will come. And about 2 hours later, my phone blew up, and I'd gone from the previous year. Yeah, four.
That's crazy.
Four unpaid sessions in 12 months. I had four sessions the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And my wife had taken the kids up to see her family up in Canberra, and she came back 2 weeks later. I had a successful business, and it was like, what is happening? I'm like, I don't know. People are just calling me for no apparent reason, and there are people all over the place. And that, to give you an idea, like, you think about it and you go, well, you know, what I do is, you know, it's out there. And but I've worked consistently between 700 and 1100 sessions a year for the last 8 years with no ads. It's only referrals. Yeah. And I get people from all over the world. And the fact that people all over the world come to me is insane. So, yeah. So this is like how these things work, is that when you get yourself into alignment with what is the truth of how reality works, reality starts co-creating with you. And it's kind of hold on. So,
These are some of the reasons I've loved being mentored by you for the last, it's been about 12 months now, I guess. Mm. And, you know, like, for example, we've spoken through so many different things like resentment. We've spoken through, you touched on the law of attraction. Let's spend some time just breaking that one down, for example. It's like manifestation is real. You can manifest anything you want, but it depends what the cost is. And I've loved this whole idea of momentum and keeping momentum. And if what you were thinking you wanted isn't on offer right now, that's okay. But what is on offer and what you pick up actually is possibly what you needed all along.
Yeah. It's a really fascinating thing. Manifestation. Manifestation has been hijacked by the secret. You know, that whole idea of New Age spirituality, which is like, if I just hold it in my mind and sit on the couch, the whole universe is going to land in my lap. I said, that's not real. To manifest, in definition, means to make something real, make something tangible. And part of that's action, big part of that's action. But that action has to be aligned with, there's a particular process, and that process, just to break it down for people, when what you think, what you feel, what you say, what you do are in alignment, that changes who you are, what you embody as an energy. And that frequency that you're embodying, that aligned frequency, that's what's going out into the universe, and that's what the universe mirrors back as manifested reality. Yeah. And it's like the double slit experiment in physics, where, you know, by observing energy changes. And I'd sent something last week about a test in Israel they were doing on live blood samples. And in the test, they had under the microscope, they're observing bacteria, they're observing the organelles in the blood. And then as part of the experiment, they got the person who they took the blood out of, they got them watching comedies. And they start laughing. And the moment they start laughing, because they're sitting like there, and they start laughing, and they watch all of the autophages, like the white blood cells, come alive and start attacking the bacteria in the blood. Wow. So they changed the footage and showed them like thriller horror movie footage, and all of that process stopped, and the bacteria went crazy and started to overwhelm the cells of the body. And you go, well, the universe is a lot more sophisticated than we think it is. And we hold ourselves into these really restrictive paradigms. So things like manifestation is very real. If you have an idea in your head and you want to make it real, and you're prepared to align not just your frequency but your actions with that, so you're going to make it. So, and if you're not, you're going to make something, and that can be adapted to something else. And there's a lot to it, because, you know, there's all the effect of the consciousness and the subconscious and, you know, the aspects of the soul and the conditioned pain body that we walk around with. So there's all these things that we need to know how to work with. in a sophisticated manner, but ultimately, yeah, everything is manifesting. There's a pen. I said, but that pen started off as an idea.
Yeah.
It just didn't turn up.
And it's so complex to make that any one individual cannot actually create a pencil.
Yeah. And the intelligence that's running all of that.
Yes.
There's a beautiful thing about this work where we actually recognize the incredible power of the divine. And I was talking to someone tonight and they just said, oh, you know, isn't it, you know, if I hadn't talked to you about this, there's no way I would have understood that. And I said, well, thank you. But isn't it wonderful that 40 odd years ago, the divine put me in a place where I could study for 40 years so I could have this conversation? Right? Yeah. Is it like, I'm not managing that. So there's things happening in my life to make sure that information comes to me, that I can share it. That means that when we have this conversation, even now, things we're talking about now, the sophisticated events, sequence of events that's brought all this to light, that we're sitting here now having a chat. So it's insane. Awesome. Yeah.
It's like that concept you were teaching me as well about the idea of vibration and our frequency. And, you know, even certain words will dull your vibration, and the opposite applies, right? So how you talk to yourself matters. What you say to other people matters. You know, your ideas, your words become who you are, or you become what they are. But equally, there is information out there through connection to consciousness that you can gather, essentially, and it will choose someone to be the vessel to become reality. And this is something that really hit me, is I spent so many years thinking about business idea. And like, I would have thought of, I don't even know how many, right, at this stage. And still struggle with this idea of even, like, you know, creating profitable business. Like, just something, there's this big block there. It doesn't work. But I don't need to, as we touched on already. It's like, you're getting all this time to spend with your young kids and your wealth's going up at the same time. Like, hello, cheat code. You found a way of doing it that's more effective than the previous generation. Well done.
That's right.
You've actually put all of your training into practice, and this is the result. And it triggers the fuck out of people because they're like, how are you getting to do what you're doing? What? No, not allowed. And they get really angry with me. But this concept of intelligence appearing only when you're operating at a certain level, that to me blew my mind, because basically all the ideas I was having were shit.
the
reason they're not working, right? Because you haven't risen high enough.
Yeah, that's right. It's incredible. There's a thing you can do, and this is the weird thing about vibration, is that sometimes we'll be talking about something, it'll be very clear in our head, and then it'll trigger like a traumatic memory. And it'll lower our frequency, and then we just lose the thread, and we don't know where it is. And I remember always thinking that it was like, oh, well, I've just forgotten it. And then one day it occurred to me that, wait a minute, knowledge lives at frequency. So I did this on a retreat. I was talking, and then I got caught in a bit of a trauma memory, and I lost the thread of it. And I said, oh, where am I? And I went, oh, okay. I said, wait a minute. And then I just connected into source energy, lifted my frequency, and next thing you know, bang, it was all back in my head, and I went, just the road joined up and away we went, like it had never went away. Wow. It was crazy to experience it. And it's just like, and anyone can do that. Anyone can do that. That's just an awareness. It's not like, you know, oh, you have to have years of training. No, you just have to be aware. If you're aware.
And that's what I like about it so much, Jason. Sorry to cut you off, because it's provable, verified.
Yeah, that's why it's a law.
You can do it, right? It's not like, oh, trust the experts, you know, or this is the history and it's true. It's like, mate, that was an event 1,000 years ago. Is that fucking real? I've got no idea, because I cannot go and check it for myself. But what I can try is exactly what you just described, which is essentially raise your vibration and see if that intelligence comes back. And what you've described is it does. Where I'd like to go now, Jason, if I may, let's say we've got another 10 minutes, we'll wrap it up, is I hosted a podcast this week with a guy called Gary. Shout out to Gary. And he began the episode by posing the question, it's like, what's your life about? And he had two answers, which was his family and Jesus. Mm. And in the latter half of the conversation, I asked him, what does Jesus mean to you? And we got into this discussion around his view of the world was that he'd gone through phases, Catholic, atheist, went through the Navy, ended up now working as a software developer and has is a Christian and has a strong faith and visits church weekly and gets great benefits from it with the community and just this idea of a creator. And having become an engineer in the way that he is, it's like the amount of complexity in this one finger, like it's by design. And so when you, Jason, reference the divine or reference consciousness, how do you look at that? Is there a creator somewhere? Or, what sits with you in that sense?
I think that, undeniably, it's the problem is everything costs. And the idea that we can, I'll give you a good example. I'm not a musical person. I don't get it. My wife is a singer, beautiful singer, and loves music. And my youngest daughter as well, you know, they're into music in a big way and they play multiple instruments and they sing and they do all those things. Right. And I love it, but I don't understand it because I haven't put the work in to understand it. I am too unsophisticated because I don't care enough to do the work that's required to get that level of sophistication because I want to do things like this. So this is where I've put my effort into. So with stuff like understanding the divine in a very deep way, you've got to be prepared to put the work in. So we will have experiences of the miraculous. We'll have experiences of grace. They're those things where, you know, where for no apparent reason, something stepped in and changed that for us. And we really should have been hit by that bus or hit by that financial bus or hit by that relationship bus or that illness or whatever. And we weren't because something stepped in there and took that away and did it with such kindness that and such ease that we are forever changed by the experience of it. But in order to appreciate that, we have to put the work in. So I've certainly had experiences of perception where you recognize the different layers of creation energetically, their frequencies, and there's frequencies beyond. And there's also, there's frequencies there that are, there's frequencies there that are so profoundly huge and immense in their intellect that they are terrifying as a human being. To come even not even to touch them, but to be in the proximity of the awareness of them. And that is that when we talk about the divine, it is very clear as an experience. It's like that thing there, that thing's running this thing, right? It is running everything. And it's not even like we're a little finger. So we're not even a skin cell. Right? There's trillions of cells in the body. This thing is far beyond those numbers. And so the scale of its intelligence and what it's creating and the fact that it has provided for us grace, it has provided for us a force of kindness and compassion and goodness that is there to nourish us, that we don't have to earn. We get it because we are part of the divine's plan. And that's it. When we start to take on that idea that maybe there's something bigger than me running this show, and we start to devote ourselves to that, it starts to reveal ourselves to it. And if that's coming to someone through Christianity or Islam or Buddhism or, you know, their own private practice, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it's about getting out of first everybody else's opinion about what you should be, getting into your own awareness of who you are, and then getting under that. Who is the who that understands? And when you get into that, it said it is not an issue of belief. It is an observation of fact. And like all those things, you know, you don't put the work, you're not going to get the result.
I'm a big fan of even that final statement. Like, if you're not willing to put the work in, don't expect any results. I think what's fun about what we've gone through today is, what direction do you go in to do the work? You know, because one can be guilty of an exuberant young man with lots of optimism and a lot of headless chicken vibes.
Yeah, yeah.
Such that you get yourself into a difficult situation where you're like, I'm completely burnt out. I have no idea why I'm doing what I'm doing. And there must be a way of learning the rules. But in lies the work, right? It's those mistakes and failures that you're like, well, that definitely wasn't the right direction. And then you can course correct, thankfully.
Yeah.
Well, okay, it's such a fascinating thing, isn't it, to even consider, like, you know, you look up at the sky, you know, what are stars? What's up there? You know, and one lives such a kind of sheltered day-to-day life, don't they? That they don't even really ever pause to, like, what's going on? Yeah. And to your point, I guess it's very much a case of peeling back the layers yourself.
Yeah.
And asking yourself the hard questions. Oh my gosh. Well, Jason, I'm not going to lie. I think that's a nice place to think about closing this up. Is there any final comments or thoughts that you feel like you haven't had a chance to share that you'd like to?
No, it's been wonderful. I think if I can leave anyone with a takeaway, the takeaway should be, just give yourself permission. It doesn't need to be, you don't have to go like Batman Begins, you know, climbing up a glacier in the middle of nowhere, right?
Really?
That sounds like a very appropriate way. Yeah. Well, look, I went off. I was a hillbilly living in the middle of nowhere in country New South Wales, and I ended up going to Shaolin Temple, and not the commercial Shaolin Temple, the actual old masters of Shaolin Temple. And that was a big process. And I went and did that, and I came back, and you go, well, now what? Right? So at the end of the day, you get to a point where you've got to say, what do I want? What do I actually want? Not what do I think I want, not what do I have to do because I've got to pay rent. And that was like, no, what do I actually want? And if you can just sit with that question long enough that you can get a proper answer out of that, so you're already building humanistic capital. And that's where all the other ones flow from.
And actually, to dovetail on that, I think one of the realizations that I've been fortunate to come to, when I asked the question, what do I want? I realized that actually a lot of the things that I've always ever wanted, I have.
Yeah.
A life of financial freedom with a wife and children. I mean, you're looking at it, Jake. What else do you want? You know, and of course you can rejig that to find other things that you want. But the point that I realized there, I guess, was just slow down, mate. It's all here already. What are you searching for? What are you running after? And perhaps that applies for many people. You know, they stop and slow down and go, well, actually, I'm just running on this pedal over here going crazy, trying to think about all this stuff that I haven't done that I apparently need to do. I step off it and I'm like, oh, I think actually it's okay. Oh,
yeah.
And that's life, isn't it? Well, that's Jason, thank you so much for your time this evening, and thank you so much for all your help the last year or so. Obviously, anyone listening, highly encourage you to reach out and book a session with Jason if it feels like the right thing, because it's been of huge value to me. So yeah, with that, Jason, I'll say thank you very much.
Thank you, Jake. It's a pleasure, always.
My pleasure. Thank you.